You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 27th of April to the 3rd of May 2017. My name is Chris Parr and I'm joined in Red Lion Square just outside THE's headquarters by editor John Gill and reporters Ellie Bothwell and John Elms. Could immigration crackdowns in the US and Australia signal a more problematic and contested era for academic and student international mobility? Ellie Bothwell has that story in just a moment. John Gill, meanwhile, has been speaking to Daniel Bonavac, a right-wing philosopher at the University of Texas at Austin, about life as a Trump-voting academic in the predominantly more left-leaning world of higher education. And John Elms delivers a very different but similarly hard-hitting interview with another scholar this week. He's been talking to the ethnographer Mark Durand, professor of organisational ethnography at the University of Cambridge, about his time witnessing the work of military surgeons in Afghanistan. But first to you, Ellie. Now, when Brexit hit, many in the UK Academy feared the impact that it could have on international student and staff recruitment. But it's not just the UK that the political climate might be damaging to universities' activities in this area, as you've been writing about this week.
Yeah, so there are two sort of significant visa changes announced last week, one in Australia and one in the US. So the Australian Prime Minister announced that there'd be changes to their visas for temporary foreign workers, and that a whole list of jobs would be removed from a list of eligible professions, including biochemist, geophysicist, historian. So the kind of professions that academics are, and also the kind of jobs that a lot of international students will be looking to move into once they graduate. Mm. And then there were also changes announced in the US, which were a bit less clear-cut, but essentially, it's changes to visas that place foreign workers in high-skilled jobs that are used by universities to recruit academics and are also used by international students once they're looking for work. And essentially, the repercussions are that it will make it harder for institutions in these countries to now recruit scholars from abroad to attract international students who are often look to settle in these countries once they've finished. And sort of coupled with the uncertainty in the UK that you mentioned, there are fears that this will lead to a much more insular higher education sector. So I was speaking to Simon Margenson, director of the Centre for Global Higher Education at UCL, who said that his concern is that it's leading to a more contested and problematic sort of era for mobility in general.
I think just to my sort of take on this, I think we talk so much about student mobility, don't we? Mainly because it's such a vital revenue stream, and obviously the sheer numbers of students who travel around the world now is enormous. But looking at the academic side of things is almost a more fundamental issue to sort of academia and the spread of knowledge and sort of freedom for ideas to cross borders and so on. One of the interesting things on the US and Australia tightening borders is that when Brexit happened, if you remember here in London, the immediate fear was that this would lead to a great flow of academic talent out of the UK, predominantly to the US, I suppose, but Australia being another obvious place that academics wanting to leave the UK might sort of set their sights. And then, of course, Trump was voted in, and suddenly, almost a silver lining of Trump being voted in from a purely parochial higher education perspective in the UK was that that obvious land of milk and honey that the sort of people who put off the UK because of Brexit, the place that they could go was suddenly less attractive. Now, this appears to be coming through now in terms of actual legislative change in the US, so it's starting to really, really sort of coalesce. And I think that's got, as Ellie said, and as indeed Simon Martin said, that's posing a pretty fundamental shift in the way that academics can view building careers. And of course, it does put additional strength in those countries that remain open to this sort of talent. So if you look at some of the very high-spending Asian countries, places like Korea or Singapore, some of these countries that are investing massively in this area, suddenly those areas become a real honeypot, probably, for some of the talent that wants to look elsewhere.
Mm. And it's a moving story as well, that ties to a blog actually we had on page 30 of this week's magazine from Sir Keith Burnett. He painted a rather rosier picture of Australia, Ellie, and your piece actually alludes to the fact that the universities out there have made some representations, and indeed this might not be the final picture and the final sort of twist in this tale.
Yeah, so I mean, since the announcement from the Australian Prime Minister, you know, the country's universities have, you know, expressed their concern, and, you know, say the government said, you know, that they'll listen to that, and you know, they're hoping that it won't affect academia as much as they originally thought. But as Vicky Thompson, who's the chief executive of the Group of Eight mission group in Australia, said, you know, even the, you know, the mere suggestion of the government clamping down on this, you know, could have a big impact. And you know, she, and as John just said, you know, she said this is a particular concern at a time when there could be opportunities to recruit particularly from the US and the UK, you know, post Brexit and post Trump.
I mean, the feature I wrote with David Matthews a few months ago, I mean, university vice chancellors in Australia, a variety of them weren't, you know, going to pounce upon academics necessarily, they were encouraged by the signs. And, you know, some of these universities are taking big kind of come and get me please, and, you know, so please for academics to look on Australia as a place to build an academic career because of these similarities in higher education systems and the potentials out there.
Mm, clashing with the government of Australia on that particular issue.
It's worth adding, before we move on, it's not only academics. I saw that zookeepers and firefighters are also amongst the list of high-skilled jobs that are no longer welcome in Australia. So if we have any zookeepers or firefighters listening, you're out of luck.
Firefighters seems really strange considering the amount of bushfires they have as well.
Well, you can Google
on fire in Australia.
Google Zookeepers and Firefighters Weekly Podcast for more on those angles. Page 5 and 6 for all on that story. You'll also find everything we discussed today on timeshighereducation.com, of course. Now, moving on. US academia tends to be dominated by those with politically liberal views. John, it's very cold out here in Red Lion Square today, but a few weeks ago you were in Texas. The University of Texas, Austin, a bit warmer I should imagine, and you were speaking with one right-wing philosopher about why he backs Trump and how a vocal minority of left-wing students are, in his view, shutting down classroom debate.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of different lines in this discussion I had. A really interesting guy, Daniel Bonovac, who's a very respected philosopher at UT Austin, somebody who actually specialises in logic and ethics, which not two words that you would necessarily associate with Donald Trump, the man who he supported to become President of the United States. But the reason I went to see Professor Bonovac was because he has actually become reasonably well known in the US as a commentator who supported Trump in the run-up to the election, clearly the interest being his academic background. And he was a sort of spokesman for a group called Scholars and Writers for America, who did sort of make the right wing case, and some of his argument for Trump is fairly familiar. You know, it's he himself came from a very blue collar background in Pittsburgh, which is one of the rust state cities that has, you know, suffered very much economically over the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, he said himself, you know, this is the problem in the Rust Belt is not one of making of the last couple of administrations. You know, you can't say it's just Obama that created this issue. It's going back a lot further than that. But he grew up in a Republican voting household. He said as a student he did actually flirt with you know, left-wing politics and actually campaign for a Democratic presidential candidate back in the 1970s, but then returned to his roots as a Republican. And he said, you know, he has certainly seen his family, his friends, the people he grew up with, their lives get worse and worse, and all those arguments you heard about voting for Trump. But he made a few other cases that I thought were particularly interesting. One was that he felt he bridled very much at this argument that there were no intelligent arguments for supporting Trump for president. He said that, you know, he didn't think that was true. He felt that as a tenured professor, you know, he was the one person who could speak out and one of the least vulnerable people on the planet, as he put it. So he felt almost a duty to make the case for Trump, given that that was the way he was going to be voting. He also made a very interesting argument about Trump supporters and supporters of the hard left candidate in the presidential election, Bernie Sanders, having a lot in common. He said, you know, a lot of academics were Sanders supporters. And the way he described it was that approaching the election last September, Trump supporters and Sanders supporters both saw the country approaching an amber light, if you like, on a traffic light. And the Trump solution was to hit the brakes. The Sanders solution was to put your foot on the gas. But Hillary Clinton didn't see the warning sign at all and thought she could just carry on as per usual. So I think that was quite an interesting argument. A whole bunch of other stuff in there about truth and Trump's approach to truth, which from a philosopher's perspective is quite interesting. The only other thing I'll mention briefly now is his personal take on you know, a couple of decades of teaching in an American, a very prestigious American university, and the way that the student demographic has changed, not the demographic so much as the student the relationship of students to their studies. And he talked about a small minority of what he described as thought police, the sort of very hard left thought police amongst the students, who have started to censor discussion, started to shout down arguments other than those to which they adhere. And actually, he says that even as he sees that other students feel unable to make arguments against this very vocal minority, but he also feels that as a professor he has sometimes felt under threat from that. So really interesting to hear his view on the way that a very homogenous left-leaning academic culture is actually influencing freedom of speech and the very nature of academic discourse.
Yeah, there was one interesting anecdote there about him being asked questions by a student in class and sort of getting the impression that they were recording everything that he was saying, and sort of stories in the US of professors coming a cropper when they are caught saying things and quoted out of context. And for the ornithologists as well, there's a good insight into the life of the great-tailed grackle in John's piece, and I urge you to check out the piece for that too. But moving on, perhaps it's fitting that we are here in Red Lion Square, overlooked by a statue of Fenner Brockway, the British politician and anti-war activist, because John Elms, your feature this week is an interview as part of our Outer Limits series, research which is outside of academics' comfort zones. And you've been speaking to a scholar who spent time with military surgeons in Afghanistan.
Yes. As you rightly say, Chris. Helicopters did come into it a little bit, but he flew in a couple. I spoke to Mark Durand, who is an ethnographer from the University of Cambridge, as you said, and ethnography is study of groups, loosely, crudely put, the study of groups of people. And he's, you know, as a researcher, he's investigated a lot of groups. I mean, he just looked at improv comedians and elite rowers, and he saw an article in a newspaper with an image of a surgical team in Afghanistan, and it piqued his interest, and he wondered about whether he would be able to maybe study medical teams in Afghanistan, and he tried to get some tried to contact the Ministry of Defence and see if he could get a embedded deployment, and he was met with short shrift by one person, but another senior medical officer had by chance read his book, An Ethnographic Study of Elite Rowers, and thought it would be a great idea to write a book about surgical teams in high pressure situations. And so after 18 months of wrangling, he managed to go and be deployed to Afghanistan. I think possibly before he went, he might have had a bit of excitement perhaps and some interest in being able to do this. When he got there, the experiences he went through in his just 6 weeks at Camp Bastion's field hospital, which he describes as the world's bloodiest, the experiences he had changed his mind somewhat. To crudely put it, someone said somewhere that you only really understand war, the people who understand war, the people who see war and experience it. And that is profoundly felt in Durand's book. His experiences are very graphic. He largely keeps himself out of it, so he describes merely what he sees, these surgical teams working under high pressures. But it's extremely graphic and visceral account of what goes on in a field hospital. Some of the descriptions of the injuries are quite quite disturbing to read, let alone experience. I can't even imagine what it'd been like to do that. And seeing the kind of things that go on in war, the effect it has on the participants in war and the victims, so civilians and the and those who are injured in a field hospital, really had a palpable effect on his psychology. Although he was able to emotionally detach himself at the time, you know, ensure that it didn't affect him, it really did affect him when he came back, especially when he started writing the book. And I mean, one of the noticeable things in the book, and quite, you know, pertinent for our academic audience, is how much what he experienced made him question his own academic purpose. I mean, he's very candid about how what he witnessed and all the trauma, the misery and the horror of war, which he doesn't undersell at all, nor does he oversell. You know, he describes it as it is. Really made him question whether what he was doing actually had any purpose. I mean, we end the feature on quite a punchy line from him, which I won't reveal, but he did question whether he could actually be an academic afterwards. And so it clearly had an effect on him as a professional and as a human. I just wanted to speak to him about his experience, and I was fortunate enough that he was extremely candid, as well as being very candid in the book.
Indeed. Well, it's a gripping read on page 40 this week, also available, as everything we've discussed today is, on timeshighereducation.com. I should also add that Professor Duron's book, Doctors at War, Life and Death in a Field Hospital, is published on the 20th of April by Cornell University Press. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You can comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine, by visiting us at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and on Twitter. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.